Welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love to talk about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always will be Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, you will believe a man can fly as we discuss Richard Donner's Superman.
All right, welcome back, guys. Cesar, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. We're coming off Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah, how was your Thanksgiving?
What's that?
How was your Thanksgiving?
Pretty good. It was a little bit busy. For people working in retail, I'm sure a lot of people know how busy it can be for the days immediately following Thanksgiving. So,
I have no idea. Please enlighten me.
Well, I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to our listeners.
I got to tell you, man, I don't want to make anybody feel bad, but it was Thanksgiving weekend was incredible. I mean, we don't have any family out here except Chelsea has one aunt, so we spent Thanksgiving with her. So I didn't have to work Thanksgiving Day at all, which was great. And Black Friday, I worked a 10-hour day, but I got paid double time for it, and I didn't have to deal with customers.
Sounds amazing.
And then Saturday and Sunday, I didn't work at all, and it was between 80 and 100 degrees. And we saw
Why don't we start talking about movies?
We saw three movies that weekend too.
It must be nice to be able to get to the theater.
It was beautiful. So I can't tell you how amazing it was.
It's like, whatever. Turkeys have to be imported to California.
Hey, they have farms out here in the desert.
They're called ranches.
All right. So, I guess first things first, we just got the Avengers Infinity War trailer just dropped this morning, literally like about an hour or so ago.
Right in our lap.
Yep. Right before a recording where we're going to talk about another superhero movie, so it was very apropos. So what did you think of the Infinity War trailer?
I mentioned that I'd only seen it the one time. There's a lot of suggested story plots that are going to be potentially happening in this film. I do wonder how much of it is Infinity War, how much of it will be for Avengers 4, or what's misdirection for the first teaser. But overall, the movie is pretty exciting. It's hard for me as a comic book fan not to get excited seeing all of this come together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Marvel Studios just turned 10 years old, right?
Yeah, evidently.
Well, they're turning 10 years old now. So, like, Iron Man was the first movie out of the gate, which came out in May of 2008, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we're not quite a year, but Infinity War will be a year exactly, right? Or 10 years exactly, right?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah. So that is very exciting. I noticed the trailer sort of builds up a nostalgic quality at the beginning. They sort of slow down and the Marvel Studios theme song is sort of like, or I guess it's the Avengers theme, but they use it for Marvel Studios. But it's a little bit slower and more mournful.
Is that a hint at some somber passings to come?
Perhaps? Yeah, I'm sure it is. I got to tell you, my favorite line in the movie is when T'Challa's like, "Evacuate the city. Engage all defenses, and get this man a shield." I love that line.
I saw you made a post about that.
Yeah, I just did right before we started recording.
Yeah. I took a quick glance at it before. Yeah. I settled down for it.
A lot of people weren't that. I mean, I wouldn't say happy, but like they kind of felt underwhelmed by the trailer. It seems. I wouldn't say that at all. I wasn't. I mean,
plenty of stuff to be excited about, I think, in this trailer.
Yeah, yeah. Stargate opening up in the middle of like New York City. Spider-Man in his what do you call that? The Iron Spider outfit or whatever.
Well, I guess that's what they're calling it. To be honest, I prefer Spider-Man just in, like regular like spandex.
Yeah.
But I guess being a bit of a classicist.
It's more breathable.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess people just want Spider-Man to be leveled up, but that's not necessarily what I want out of a Spider-Man costume. Yeah. I think it looks good, but...
If it's just for an Avengers movie, that's fine. He's not going to be wearing that, you know, in any other movies that he's doing, I'm sure.
Yeah, I guess so.
It looks like he might even get killed, although... Thanos punches the shit out of him.
Isn't that Iron Man that he punches?
I'm pretty sure it's Spider-Man.
Well. See, I thought it was Iron Man, but, well, what do I know? I only watched it the once. I know, well, like, in the Infinity Gauntlet storyline, Thanos does kill Iron Man in the comic book series, so...
Mm. Well, they don't really hint at that in the trailer, but you know they're promising that these two movies, Avengers 3 and 4, whatever they end up calling the next one, are going to shake up the Marvel universe, and all these Phase 1 actors like Chris Hemsworth and Chris Evans and Robert Downey are going to be gone. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they're all going to die, but they're going to shift into a different direction. But some of them might die, and it might make sense, you know, to kill Downey off.
Yeah, I think so. He's kind of the figurehead for the entire MCU in terms of actors.
Yeah. I hope they don't, but, you know. Cause
well, you can do pretty much anything.
Yeah.
I guess the Infinity Gauntlet, I guess once all of the gems are put together, each film that kind of deals with an Infinity Jewel, Infinity Gem, is... all about how powerful this particular artifact is. I guess once you put it into the gauntlet, like in the comics, pretty much anything will be possible.
Right.
So that's kind of like an automatic Deus Ex Machina
kind of
item. So,
did you have any favorite moments? I know you said you only watched it once.
I guess that final shot where like a bearded Cap and Black Panther and everyone and the Wakandans are running through like the forest, I guess, into a big Lord of the Rings style battle sequence, I imagine.
I wonder who they're fighting. I mean, is it just the Chitauri again that are there with Thanos, or is it somebody else?
I think it is, because isn't there a scene when like there's a number of them running out of trees, or is that supposed to be the Wakandans?
I don't know. I can't, like, I didn't break it down like frame by frame or anything, but I couldn't tell like who was battling who.
Well, there's a scene when, I want to say it's Cap, he is engaging hand-to-hand with a Chitauri, I guess. A Chitauri without armor. Or something with multiple arms, so who knows. I mean, this is a really bad discussion. I should have watched it a second time. Discussing it.
All right, well, we can move on from this. But, I'm excited for it. You know, it's a long time coming. They've built to this, you know, through how many movies now? Is it like 17 or 18?
Yeah, I guess it's going to be 22 by the end of it, though, yeah.
Is that what it is? Okay. It's so hard to keep track of the Marvel movies now. Like, we're at that point where I just, like, I don't care about the number anymore, but it's a significant number of movies.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible how many.
They should just start numbering them. Like, Marvel Studios number 15, Marvel Studios number 63.
Marvel Studios Tokyo Drift.
I'm not doing it.
How about Marvel Studios Electric Boogaloo?
No, not doing it. Cool. All right. Well, before we move on to our main topic, which is Superman the movie from 1978, directed by Richard Donner, anything you've watched recently that you want to recommend to the nice people at home?
I recently just posted a written review for a movie called Umimachi Diary. It's a Japanese dramatic film from 2015. It's directed by a guy named Hirokazu Koreeda, and it is probably one of the most enjoyable movies I've seen in probably the past year or two. It's a terrific Japanese film, and I think I've actually watched it twice in the past 2 weeks. So most recently yesterday evening for my second time. But it was excellent, excellent movie.
Nice. Well, what's it about?
Well, it's based on a manga. The story surrounds a group of sisters, the Koda sisters, who have grown up without a father. Their father had left their family and with his mistress, and they kind of grew up without a father. They're fine. They've gotten along well. You have the eldest sister tends to have a little bit of responsibility, who tends to be overly responsible, and the middle and younger sisters who tend to be a little bit more carefree. They get notice that their father has died in another town, so they go to pay their respects, and while they're there, they meet their half-sister, who now has no one left to take care of her. When they see her, they decide to invite her to live with them because they live in like a huge old house. And the movie is basically about the younger sister and the older sister older sisters becoming family. Absolutely terrific performances. It's filled with veteran actors as well as the female leads who are kind of like a mix of some of like the most popular, female actors of this millennia in Japan. It's just absolutely excellent. I don't want to say too much because I actually want people to read the review, but it's a movie I'm looking forward to revisiting many times in the years to come.
Awesome, cool. Well, definitely for everyone out there, read the review on Film Smash, and it's linked already on the Celluloid Jelly Facebook page. So click on it, give them the hits.
Yep, click, 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 guys.
There you go.
Terrific movie. Now, you mentioned that you went to watch three films at the theater this past weekend. Anything good that you want to talk about?
Not super in depth, but we saw, doing a little, 2017 catch up. So, we saw Coco, Three Billboards, and, Lady Bird. Mm-hmm. So, and all were good, to varying degrees. In particular, did you see any of them?
I did not, no. I'm
okay.
Looking forward to hear what you think about them.
Well, I don't want to spoil anything. Coco was incredibly entertaining, very heartfelt, fighting back some tears in a couple of scenes, personally. And I know Chelsea had a rough time through some of it too. So it's quite good. The animation's beautiful. I was a little disappointed in the predictability of the story, and one particular, I don't want to call it a twist, but like a reveal that they do towards the end of the film that I thought was unnecessary, that I would certainly be willing to talk about one-on-one with people who have seen it. But I did not personally care for. That said, I still thought it was, very entertaining. And like I said, the animation was beautiful. The music was great. So I definitely recommend it for anyone who's interested.
Yeah, I do want to watch it. I was a fan of Book of Life. So I'm kind of interested to hear or to view a film with similar, looks like, subject matter and themes.
Yeah, one of the things about Coco that I think was really cool, and I've heard people who are bilingual talk about this, they really depict the bilingualism in the movie in a very realistic way. So they don't subtitle the Spanish stuff. Most of it is in English, but, anybody who is bilingual, whether it be, a Spanish-speaking person or, French-speaking or whatever. A lot of times, like, when they get upset, they start to speak in their more dominant language and things like that, and they do that in Coco, and I think that's really cool.
Awesome.
So.
Who directed Coco?
Lee Unrich, or Unrich, who did Toy Story 3, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Was this only his second feature film?
I wouldn't be able to say. I'm not sure. I think he co-directed a couple of movies before doing Toy Story 3, right? He might have co-directed Finding Nemo. With Andrew
he
Stanton.
Might be right.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but
a lot of earlier Pixar films did have double directors working on them.
Well, even Coco does. Like they always have like your main creative director, which is usually the guy they bill as the director, and then they also have like a co-director credit, who's usually my understanding of it is that person is sort of more like a talent wrangler. Like they go in between departments and make sure communication between departments is, you know, is flowing smoothly and stuff like that. So, but in any case, Coco, really good. Lady Bird, I liked, and I thought it was really well done, really well acted. It didn't blow me away though. But I still, you know, anybody who's interested, definitely see it. It's got some great moments in it. And it's a really strong debut for Greta Gerwig as a feature director. And she had co-written a couple of movies with Noah Baumbach previously, but this was her first time directing. So it's really solid. I enjoyed it, but I probably won't end up buying it on Blu-ray or anything like that.
Yeah, the trailer had me interested in it, certainly.
Yeah. And Three Billboards, I really enjoyed it. I think there's a lot more to unpack in that movie. And it's not, you know, I don't want to take up too much of our time here. So I would say if you're interested in it, go see it. A lot has been made about the character that Sam Rockwell plays, who is a police officer in a small town who has been accused of beating a black suspect previously and really doesn't have any repercussions for that. So a lot of people were turned off by that particular aspect of the story and the idea that he really doesn't get a whole lot of repercussions for anything that he does despicable in the movie. But that particular film had one of my favorite moments of the year so far. So I don't want to reveal what that is just yet, but, so if you're interested in Three Billboards, you know, highly recommend it. You know, terrific performances. I was not a huge fan of Martin McDonagh's, Seven Psychopaths, but I did like In Bruges quite a bit.
Yeah, In Bruges.
So I definitely recommend this one too.
Yeah. I haven't seen Seven Psychopaths, but I think, most people I know seem to really, really love In Bruges.
Yeah, In Bruges is great. So, hey. Superman the movie. 1978. Yep. Now, originally, we had picked this film to coincide with the release of Justice League.
Which, you know, I still haven't seen it.
Ah, well.
That's okay. We're talking about Superman.
That's true. That's true. Superman. So I will save my Justice League comments until after you see the movie, and after you see it, we can always talk about it on a future episode.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think it's as bad as a lot of other people are saying, though.
We'll see.
So, hey, Cesar, what's Superman the movie about?
Okay. Superman the movie is based on the most iconic DC Comics character. It revolves around Kal-El, a castaway survivor from the planet Krypton who arrives on Earth and is imbued with fantastic abilities in his endeavor to be a superhero in Metropolis and the world. Along the way, he goes up against Lex Luthor, a megalomaniac genius who has a plot to destroy a good portion of the country.
Yes.
There you go.
Perfect. I had not sat down and watched this movie for quite a while, so it was a real treat.
It's been a while for me too. Like, to be honest, like, I really like this film a lot, but I can't remember the last time I sat down and watched the film in its entirety. For my screening, I watched the 3-hour TV version.
Right, so did I. I picked up that Blu-ray from Warner Archive a few weeks back. So
now, because I hadn't sat down and watched the film in a long time, there are a number of scenes that I remember or that I recall were different, but at the same time, I feel like I'm mixing up the director's cut and the theatrical cut together too. And now this third version, certain scenes, I'm not sure where they went together or what scene is exclusive to which version. So I'm going to hopefully trust you to know a little bit more about it?
Well, I think I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to expertly sort of dissect it in that way. But just a little bit of background, you know, in 1978, there was no home video market. And the big event, when movies left theaters, the big event would be when they would play the movie on television. So, you know, ABC had their Sunday night movie, you know, and that was usually the big stay-at-home, gotta watch it event. Sort of like Monday Night Football was for sports fans, or ABC's Wild World of Sports, which was a Saturday program, was if you were a sports fan, you had to sit down and watch that because there was no internet. And you didn't get anything except local stuff. So when Monday Night Football came on, you got a chance to see national teams. And when the Wide World of Sports came on, you got a chance to see sports from other countries and things that you wouldn't ever see normally. Now we have the internet and we can watch all that shit, you know, whatever. But same thing with movies. So once a movie left the theater, the big TV event, you know, that's what they did. And for Superman, they actually split it into two halves and added, 40 minutes of extra footage?
Roughly 40 minutes.
Yeah, to pad it out. And they made it a two-night event where they played, you know, the first half on a Sunday and the second half on a Monday. So a lot of this stuff feels extraneous. You know, a little bit like filler maybe in some places. But a lot of it's really cool. There's extended scenes on Krypton, which is, you know, we'll talk about that, I guess, in a little while. It looks awesome. You know, there's, I think they added this back into Donner's special edition, but when Superman sees Lex Luthor, for the first time, there's a bunch of tests that Lex Luthor sort of goes and puts on him as far as like machine guns and fire and ice and things that where he's testing Superman's ability to overcome certain obstacles.
Mm-hmm. There's more Jimmy Olsen. I definitely noticed that.
Yeah, there's definitely more Jimmy Olsen and the...
Which is what you want, more Jimmy Olsen.
Absolutely. Mark McClure, come on. The oldest McFly kid. And Lois's story that she's on at the end of the film that takes her to California is better explained in the 3-hour TV cut too.
Yes, I agree.
So like you don't get any of that, in the original version, except for her, a little snippet of her interview in the car with the guy. But there's a lot more to it in the 3-hour cut. The whole thing about the Hoover Dam pulling water from Native American tribal lands is completely missing from the original movie.
Yep.
So there's definitely stuff, you know, if you thought Return of the King needed 40 minutes extra, you know, because you're a big fan of the book, and you wanted to be a completist and see every inch of film that they shot for that film, for Superman fans, this is the same thing. You know, you're getting the longest, most complete, maybe not the director's vision for the film, you know, not the best version of the film, but the most complete story-wise.
Okay, so you only watched a 3-hour version. You didn't watch any of the other earlier releases, though, did you?
No, not for this particular screening.
Okay.
However, I did throw the Blu-ray on and listen to just the score-only version. As I was doing something else, and man, that John Williams music fucking rocks.
It's so goddamn good.
Honestly,
I want to feel stuff, and Superman's score definitely makes me feel emotions.
It's really remarkable. The Superman March is probably one of the best pieces of movie music in the history of cinema.
Absolutely.
I really believe that. It's
thinking about it, considering like John Williams' like huge body of iconic work, I definitely think the Superman theme is probably my favorite piece of work that he's done.
Yeah, I love the Indiana Jones march, and I love a lot of the pieces, you know, for Star Wars. You know, I mean, Star Wars is probably, you know, one of my favorite soundtracks ever. You know, but Superman is definitely up there too. The original Superman theme, the Kryptonian theme that they use at the beginning of the movie has like a really... We talked about the Avengers trailer and how it sort of had more of a somber feeling to it. I feel like the Kryptonian theme is very regal, but at the same time, there's a doomed or somber quality to it as well. And it, like, will it, nobody captures the emotion of what should go into the music better than John Williams does, I think.
Yeah, he tends to have like a lot of epic scale to a lot of his works, but I mean, he's attached to a lot of really large global globe-trotting expansive movies too, though.
Yeah, he's been fortunate in his career to be handed a bunch of huge movies that gave him the opportunity to put these giant orchestral scores, you know, out there. You know, I mean, without Jaws, would he have ever gotten Star Wars? You know, without Star Wars, would he have ever gotten Superman? You know, I mean, so, yeah, we might have had a Jerry Goldsmith Superman score, you know, had Star Wars never happened or something like that. So, you never know. But, you know, he's just, you know, I saw him live. I think we talked about it on one of our podcasts.
Yeah,
I saw him live earlier this year, and the Superman theme was not part of his original programming. And he did four encore pieces, you know, for a guy who's in his 80s. I thought that was amazing. So he came back out and played a couple of things. And I was hoping, I even told Chelsea, she was with me, I was hoping that he would do the Superman theme as an encore, and he did. Like, so I was super psyched. So I got to see him do the Superman March live, and it was amazing.
All right, thanks for bragging again.
Sorry.
California is so much better.
Hey, John Williams, I missed him in Baltimore. He was in Baltimore like 2 years ago or something like that. Yeah. So when I lived in Baltimore, I didn't see him. I had to come out here to see him. So.
Cool. That's fine. Acceptable.
All right. Thank you. I like the way this movie opens with that sort of black and white pre-credit scene. The opening of the Superman comic and the child's voiceover. I thought that was a nice classic way for Richard Donner to open, you know, the first real big budget comic book movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like those old Disney films that are based on storybooks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's hard for, you know, I'm in my 40s. You're in your 30s. It's hard for a lot of people who did not grow up in that era, though, to really understand, like, how to place this movie historically. You're like, oh, yeah, it came out in 78, you know. But in 1978, the undertaking of a Superman movie with the scope and budget and ambition of this movie was just unheard of. And Alexander Salkind, who produced the film, you know, had to have been like a crazy person to, you know, to do this. You know, it was really, you know, now it's almost, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, it's easy for a studio to look at a comic book and see a giant IP that they can exploit and make a huge franchise out of. But there wasn't anything like that in 1978.
Sure.
I mean,
a lot of times some of the biggest or most important things that happen in film is, you know, taking a risk, you know? I feel like one of the things that's missing in today's studio system is that there's no risk. I'm sure a lot of people would agree with the deluge of sequels and adaptations and reboots and everything that's coming out in or coming out of Hollywood these days.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of financial risk out there, but there's not a lot of risk with ambition and on material. So I think you're right about that.
Yeah.
Obviously, there was a Superman TV show with George Reeves that was very popular, and before that, there were serials with Kirk Allen and the Max Fleischer cartoons. So, I mean, Superman was... you know, like Mickey Mouse, a very recognizable worldwide thing, but the idea that they would make such a giant movie out of it had never been done before. And at one point, I think in one of the behind-the-scenes things, let me see. Oh, there it is. Sorry. Obviously, they were going to make two movies together. They ended up stopping and finishing the first movie and firing the director and then going on to do the second one later and reshooting a bunch of stuff. But for they were going to make two movies. It was an epic production. They 19 months of shooting, 11 different units filming simultaneously across three continents, 1,000 crew members, and it was quote-unquote the largest production budget to date for a movie. So it was a big deal.
Kind of a big deal.
It was kind of a big deal for this movie to get made. So you're a huge Superman fan.
Yeah, he is absolutely my favorite DC superhero. My number two superhero at all, though. But Superman is...
Is that because Spider-Man's your number one?
Spider-Man's my favorite superhero.
Okay. Yes. But Superman's your favorite DC. Gotcha.
Absolutely.
So, like, I don't recall there being any sort of, like, you know, backlash. You know, obviously, I was very young when this movie came out, but... like, does this follow the comic book origin pretty well?
It does some stuff. Now, Superman himself is a character that's had a lot of revisions and inspiration taking from the various mediums that he's appeared in. The idea, for instance, of, like, kryptonite is a concept that was from the radio program, as opposed to being originally introduced in the cartoon. The TV series and other things like Fleischer's animated series would introduce things like flight and other superpowers later on, which would slowly be folded in to the character. Comic books themselves, particularly DC comics, especially in the 70s, had a tendency of kind of like starting fresh. I guess you could equate them to like reboots in film series these days. Around the time that Superman film came out, there was an event called Crisis on Infinite Earths, which kind of restarted the Superman and the entire DC universe. Not from scratch.
Really? Was that that long ago? That was in the 70s?
Crisis?
Yeah. Gosh.
Now I have to look it up now. when I say around that time, you know, but I mean, they definitely have like 70s hair.
Yeah.
No, it was mid-80s, so
okay.
But like Crisis, for instance, kind of like restarted, but that's not uncommon. Superman had a number of comic books that all kind of ran on their own continuity as well, too. So
could Crisis have been sort of like a reaction to the Superman movies in any way?
I don't think specifically Superman entirely, though, of course, being at the time, the most iconic character, you know, with cartoons and the successful film series, you know, it would certainly be something that they considered, but it was a pretty, like, far-reaching event. The Superman family, I guess you could say, was pivotal in that storyline, but...
By family, do you mean, like, Supergirl and Crypto the Superdog and...
Yeah, you know, I guess, like, the supporting characters, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Particularly is the most important thing about Crisis and Superboy. So
now explain this to me. How does Superboy exist while Superman is around? Like, is Superboy not Clark Kent?
It's another universe. There's a Superboy who becomes all powerful and in doing so becomes evil. He looks to bring about like the death of the universe, and Crisis on Infinite Earths is kind of like a multiverse storyline.
Okay.
Where I guess like the universe up to then comes into conflict with that Superboy, and most famously, it results in the death of Supergirl. There's a pretty famous picture of Superman holding a dead Supergirl in his arms.
I have seen that. Okay, yeah.
And basically, at the end, the world is kind of remade. honestly, I kind of feel that we talked earlier about the Avengers trailer and how things are going to kind of restart. With the Infinity Gauntlet, I kind of feel they'll probably take a similar stance and they'll have like a new Marvel universe in film, new MCU, I suppose. But
yeah,
you know, I guess you could say DC Comics were kind of like the progenitor to that.
Okay. I know one of the big sticking points for some fans is Gene Hackman's portrayal of Lex Luthor. How do you feel about that?
I love Gene Hackman. We were talking about during the Young Frankenstein how good his scene is.
Absolutely.
And in particular, I think the reason I suggested to do Superman was in no small part because of Gene Hackman.
Nice. Yeah, he's terrific. I think, you know, it's not the traditional take on Lex Luthor by any means, but I think he's hilarious. I love his dynamic with Eve Tesbacher and with Otis.
I love Otis.
Otis is the man, yeah.
It's a little itty bitty place. That's my favorite line in the whole film. So.
It's a good one. I love that scene. Otisburg?
He has the S in Otisburg spelled like it backwards. Like,
yeah. I love that in that earlier in that same scene when Lex Luthor's like, take the gentleman's cape, Otis, and he's like, he looks at Superman and Reeves, Christopher Reeve just gives him this look, and he just looks back at Gene Hackman and goes, I don't think he wants me to.
that particular moment, I actually definitely considered changing that to my cover photo on Facebook for a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, in that moment, I was sitting, when I was watching that, I definitely considered it. Like, the moment when Superman's just looking at him, and Ned Beatty's looking at us, like, almost like at the camera through, towards Lex. So, just that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but this time watching the movie, I never made the connection before, but obviously, you know, they were making these two movies at once, and the beginning of this film, if they never made a Superman 2, a lot of the stuff in the beginning in Krypton would not be necessary. All the stuff with General Zod would be, like, what the fuck?
They didn't first appear in a release, I think, except for the director's cut version. They weren't in the theatrical cut, if I remember correctly, right?
I'm pretty sure they're in the theatrical cut, but not, like, I think the scenes cut a little bit shorter.
Okay.
But I never made this connection. Zod, Ursa, and Nan. Zod is, like, you know, the mastermind. Ursa is, like, the devoted woman who loves him. And Nan is, like, the dim-witted sidekick. You know, he uses him as muscle, but he's, you know, that's what he is. So they're the three most dangerous criminals on Krypton. And on Earth, Lex, Eve Tesbacher, and Otis have the exact same dynamic, but it's just played for, you know, shtick.
You know, I kind of feel that... that's an interesting thought. I kind of feel like that triple villain dynamic, though, has existed in, like, probably many cartoons and stuff before Superman.
You're probably right. I just never picked up on that before, that they have, like, the exact same relationships, essentially.
Well, you know, Ursa doesn't betray Zod, though, I guess, so.
No, but, well, I mean, it's not a straight one-to-one thing, but it's like they're kind of, like, set up as a template, and then they kind of, like, just play off of it a little bit. So, but I was like, that blew my mind a little bit.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Well, it's not easy. It's not hard. Speaking of the beginning of this movie, Krypton looks amazing, and Krypton was never portrayed in the comics as, like, a planet of crystals, was it? That was specifically for the movie, right?
Well, I think, like, it looked more like kind of like Jetsons, like almost like saucers on top of towers. And,
okay. Yeah, because in one of the behind-the-scenes documentaries...
Sci-fi, you know, but...
Yeah.
Not really crystals. Like, it's the crystal idea probably say the movie helped build that element of the Superman universe.
Yeah.
Or popularized it, at least.
They give credit to John Barry, who was the production designer, and he did Star Wars too. But Richard Donner gives credit to John Barry for coming up with the idea of crystals for Krypton. Mm-hmm. But Krypton looks awesome.
I want one of those glowy Kryptonian suits.
Yeah, well, the whole thing, the stark blackness of like the judicial chamber or the whatever the council chamber that they're in. The hula hoop like security force field things, they're awesome. The reflective material on the costumes, which was actually the same kind of material that they use for movie screens, which is very reflective and actually amplifies the light when it reflects it. You know, the pulsating energy of the crystals that surrounds them constantly on Krypton. And the lack of color, the whole, like, black and white sort of aspect of it. You know, I mean, red becomes prominent during the destruction sequence, but, you know, like, it's all sort of, like, black and white or black and silver, monochromatic. Love the whole thing. There's definitely, like, yeah, like, Krypton's supposed to be, like an advanced benevolent race or whatever, but like I totally get like a 1984 Orwellian totalitarian-ish feeling from it.
Well, maybe it's because everyone's wearing the same kind of all like a uniform kind of thing.
Well, visually you've got like the giant faces that are projected in the council chamber. It's like that's a very like 1984 type image. And like I love it. It's almost evil in its, you know, in its own way though, but like the way they all sort of like,
it's because they're idiots. They didn't listen to Jor-El.
Well, the way they silence him though, and you know, like the council has spoken and like they basically have to shut him up, and then everyone physically falls in line. There's that shot where they all move to one side of the room opposite him. Like it's almost chilling in a way. And so I like, I kind of feel like that, that the depiction of government on Krypton is sort of like a, almost like a post Watergate thing. Like there's a mistrust to it.
Well, I mean, you only see it through, that particular echelon. You don't see like the social, appearance of, you know, the people who live in Krypton, everyone else, the everyday person. You only see like the people who are making decisions that, higher council, you know?
Right, that's true, but I feel like that was very timely back then, considering, you know, where we were as a country.
Well, I didn't grow up in that period, but I guess it might have something there. I'm not sure.
Anyway, let's move on.
Okay.
And how do the Kryptonians know Einstein's theory of relativity?
You know, I don't know. It's just, maybe it's a suit that you talking about like during like the education bits?
Yeah. They seem to know a lot about Earth. Like there's, I mean, obviously in the movie they don't have time to do this, but has there been a history of like Kryptonians visiting Earth in the past?
Depending on what you read, there have been ideas of Kryptonians visiting Earth and other planets. Like Man of Steel suggests that Kryptonians colonized Earth in the past, amongst other things. The TV series, if I remember correctly, Smallville, suggested that idea multiple times.
Yeah.
It's, you know, just an idea. You know, Krypton is a planet that was always seen as kind of like the highest of order and intelligence amongst all the other planets in the galaxies in the DC universe, but they just happen to be gone. Kind of like the way people view Atlantis as having been some kind of super technological society that just happens to be lost in time now.
Cool.
Almost fantastical, yeah?
Yeah. It's just like, just a handful of things strike me, you know, like the idea that they know about Einstein's theory of relativity, you know, like, and when Jor-El is talking to Kal-El and he says, you know, they can be a great people, Kal-El, they wish to be. So like that whole idea that how they know about Earth's culture and stuff is never really explored or explained. But I still think it's interesting.
Well, the crystal technology, I mean, this is just something, they definitely don't explain it, but the crystal technology, I guess you could assume, who knows what goes into it. It could be something that is able to take information. I mean, they know about Earth and its existence and its inhabitants. Maybe the crystals are something that are teaching Kal-El all of this stuff during his incubation or travel. Maybe they have some way to do it, to absorb information or extract it. I mean, you're talking about comic books. There's no fantasy, so whatever's the easiest explanation, I suppose.
They're just picking up radio waves, right? That's what it is.
Yeah.
All those TV and radio broadcasts that we've been doing.
Yeah, all those Gilligan's Island reruns and Star Trek reruns and stuff.
Yep. Cool. I like that there's three main like sequences to this film. Essentially, you got your Kryptonian opening, and you've got like all the Smallville stuff, which is really very sort of middle America, kind of like Norman Rockwell-ish Americana, and then everything in Metropolis is much more duplicitous, fast-paced, loud. You got that concrete jungle aspect to it, essentially.
You have some definite Judeo-Christian overtones that exist with the Superman mythology.
Oh, yeah.
They kind of go pretty heavy-handed in Superman Returns from Bryan Singer. But of course, you know, you talk about like the three elements. You see Superman being analogous to Jesus Christ. You see him in Krypton as a baby. In Smallville, you see him as a teenager, echoing, I guess, like Jesus's appearance as a teen in a temple.
Right.
And then you don't see him again for years until he's a grown 30-year-old man.
Right. Yeah, there's like 12 years pass when he's just like in the Fortress of Solitude.
Yeah. Learning.
Yep.
Getting that knowledge.
But there's three different settings, three criminals. Yeah, so there's definitely like that Trinity thing going on.
Yeah.
I think it was Tom Mankiewicz who basically wrote the entire screenplay but was uncredited, said that he wanted Krypton to be semi-biblical. You know, obviously, you know, you've got the obvious thing with Jor-El sending his only son to Earth and that sort of thing. But you've got those characters speaking in sort of stilted, elegant English, as he puts it in the documentary. So they definitely were aware of what they were doing. It was definitely intentional.
Yeah.
Apparently, when Richard Donner was hired, he was actually not the first director on the movie. Did you know that?
Who was the first director?
The first director they hired was Guy Hamilton, who directed Goldfinger and Force 10 from Navarone.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to shoot the movie in Italy originally, and Guy Hamilton was signed on, and when they moved the production to England, Guy Hamilton wasn't able to go back to England. Something about his citizenship prevented him from going back to England for any length of time, but they were going to shoot the movie in England. So Donner was hired and apparently was offered $1 million to direct the two movies together. And his biggest movie before that was The Omen. And he only got $100,000 to direct that, so he like immediately said yes, without even looking at a script. But when he got the script, it was apparently like 500 pages long and campy. And that's when he hired Mankiewicz to rewrite the script.
Wasn't Mario Puzo involved in?
Yes, which is probably how they got Brando on, since Puzo's the guy who wrote The Godfather. So.
Yep.
apparently verisimilitude became their mantra.
Verisimilitude, I love that word.
Yeah. It's not easy to spell. It's fun to say, though.
Yeah. I just imagine Richard Donner, like, you know, the Salkins, dangling a check for $1 million in front of him.
Yeah.
Like, leaping out of his seat to grab it.
Apparently he was on the toilet when he got the phone call, so.
Oh, yeah. He did leap at attention, I guess. Did he have a phone in the bathroom?
You know, they had cords that could extend, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the president also had wireless phones. In this film, they did, on this golf cart.
Yeah.
It's not as far back as we thought. They did have payphones back then, though, so, which is weird to see today. But
it's funny, like, Clark Kent wears a fedora, like, but that's not really, like, a 70s thing. That's more of like a, that's like a throwback to the comic, I guess. You know, from like the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, it's pretty swell.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder. Reeve is, I mean, obviously, you know, he's my Superman. He's the Superman that I grew up with. But I still think he's the best Superman, and I still think he, like, I don't think anybody beats him as far as, like, how he carries himself when he's in the suit.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah,
almost even close.
I love the way he's able to sort of shift his body language back and forth between Clark and Superman.
Yeah, he develops a bit of a hunch when he's Clark.
Yeah, and a stammer, which is nice. And it's just like, there's, you know, we talked about like watching the 3-hour director's cut or 3-hour TV version of this. There's a moment right after Clark meets Lois in Perry White's office, when they leave his office and he, you know how he walks behind her and almost gooses her by accident and she like shoots up and he gets really embarrassed. He sits down at his desk and he's sort of like shaking his head, and then he looks up at her, and in the original version, they sort of cut there. In the 3-hour TV version, they sort of let that linger a bit, and he just is sort of, you can tell he's smitten, like, but they don't cover the scene or go in for a close-up or anything. It's played out in a long shot, and I just thought that was a really nice moment that the 3-hour version was able to sort of provide that you don't get in the original version, where he just sort of looks at Lois for a while.
And yeah, he gets interrupted when he shakes the hand of his cubicle buddy, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I've never been a huge fan of Margot Kidder. How do you feel about her as Lois Lane?
I think she was the first, like, I guess, flesh and blood version of Lois Lane, so she kind of defined the character.
Well, only for that generation. I mean, Noelle Neal was Lois Lane in both the serials and the TV series.
Oh yeah, well, in film, I suppose. But
yeah.
There's she's the right amount of sass, which I like. She's kind of like one note though. But I guess Lois Lane is a character in the Superman comics who typically didn't have a lot of personality.
Yeah. Well, she's usually portrayed in other media, whether it be comics or even like the TV series with Noelle Neal, as being sort of like a really together professional woman. And I like that Margot Kidder and Richard Donner kind of, she's a mess.
Sure. She tends to be pretty frazzled, I guess.
Yeah.
Most of the things you see her in.
You
know, she's good at what she does, but to the detriment of everything else.
And Superman does not help things. Once Superman shows up on the scene, then she's not only a mess, but she's sort of like doe-eyed about the whole thing. And I love that we're introduced to her with the like how many T's in bloodletting?
Yeah.
And then how do you spell massacre? And then there's only one P in rapist. So like, you get.
I want to read that that story.
Yeah, you only get a sense of like the type of reporter, hard-nosed reporter that she is, just from like her handing a story into Perry White and having the spelling errors and stuff. And I actually, even though I'm not that big a fan of Margot Kidder, I think she's really good in this movie. And I think that's a perfect introduction to her, actually.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot of things you glean just from her very first scene.
Yeah, definitely. And how she never looks Clark in the eye, for the most part.
Yeah, there's an interview in the documentary Look Up in the Sky, The Amazing Story of Superman.
Uh-huh.
Where she says she kind of took that from her own personal life, where she had a tendency not to look at men in the eye and be very dismissive unless she was interested in them, like her character would have been Superman.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Look at that. Margot Kidder breaking out the method acting.
I guess. It was easy just playing herself.
How do you feel about the "Can you read my mind" flying sequence?
I think it's kind of hammy, like her voiceover, and you know, I guess the song. I mean, I feel like that was a song that, who knows, it probably won like best original song or something.
I didn't check, but you're probably right.
I think like the whole sequence. I mean, it's a nice moment when they're flying together, but her voiceover and you know, the "Can you read my mind" stuff, I think it's pretty cheesy, to be completely honest with you. I guess there's not really a good way to visualize it. Maybe just limits it's just limitations of Margot Kidder's acting and physical acting ability.
You know, I respect that. I'm not sure I agree. I think as a kid, I was like, this is really boring and girly. But I think as I've grown, I think I can appreciate it on a different level, as far as just bringing a different dynamic to the story and changing a POV and what would it be like if, I mean, because Superman's all about the perfect man. Yeah, you know, he's the, you know, the strongest, the fastest, you know, all that stuff. And what would it be like for a girl to actually find this person, you know, and what would it do to her? And I sort of like that about it.
Can you read my mind? Do you know what it is that you do to me? I don't know who you are. Just a friend from another star.
And from a different aspect, Superman sort of, I guess if you look at it on paper, it's a boy's story. And the idea of sort of changing and giving you the point of view of the female character sort of opens it up and opens it up for girls to have an entry point as well. And sort of makes it, you know, more of an all audience picture. In a way, I don't know.
I guess so. I mean, yeah. She's the female lead, so there's a decided lack of Lois Lane in the Superman movie. Once Gene Hackman's introduced, the focus is taken away from almost any other human actor, aside from that one scene with Lois on the rooftop.
Really? Like, I'm not. I mean, I know, like, later in the picture, like, once she leaves...
Lois and Clark have barely any scenes together after that, because you delve, you know, she goes to California with Jimmy, Clark stays in Metropolis. You tend to focus more on Lex Luthor's crime, because you probably don't get introduced to Lex Luthor until halfway through, in the three-hour cut, at least like an hour and a half into the picture.
Well, yeah, the three-hour cut, there's definitely, because they have extended sequences that have to do with the missiles, you do get a lengthy sequence without Lois and Jimmy for the most part. But I think there's a good hour of the film, like, in the middle. Like, once he gets to Metropolis and meets Lois to the point where she leaves for California, that's a good chunk of the movie. And she's a huge part of it.
Well, like, you have...
You got all the scenes in the Daily Planet that lead to the night where he comes out and becomes Superman. Uh-huh. You've got the interview. You've got the "Can you read my mind" stuff. And then
what happens after that? Like, what scenes do they have together that are memorable?
Well, that's a lot, though, isn't it? That's a lot of screen time.
I don't know. Maybe it doesn't feel as much because we watched 3 hours and 8 minutes of Superman.
Maybe. Anyway, moving on to Lex Luthor. Yeah, I love Gene Hackman. I think his take on Lex Luthor is fun, but at the same time, it's kind of a joke that he's quote unquote the greatest criminal mind of our time, where he lives in the subway and the only people that he has at his, you know, beck and call are Otis and Eve Tessmacher.
Well, I mean, look at what he's able to accomplish, though, with those two. Like, they hijack, like, missiles and, like, reprogram them. You know, he's taken over, like, whole sections of the subway. He's, you know, got all this security stuff
That is true.
Man, like... I mean, obviously he's narcissistic. Maybe he feels better by surrounding himself with people who aren't even close to him intellectually.
Right. No, I think you're right. But at the same time, it's like, you know, we tend to think of powerful criminals in a much different light these days.
Yeah, I guess so. Like, yeah. Kingpins of crime or...
Right.
There's something I always thought that was funny, even as a kid watching this film. Is how, you know, his whole plan is to create a new West Coast made up of land that he owns, but he's kind of known as a criminal already, as evidenced by, like, the police tailing Otis trying to find Lex Luthor.
Right.
Like, if he succeeds and he owns all this land, like, is he still not a criminal that people are looking for? Is that the name of this thing? You know, Lex Lutherville.
I think that sort of goes, like, doesn't Lex Luthor in the comics, isn't he a known criminal, but they just can't really pin anything on him?
I guess so, but the cops are looking for Otis specifically, so this movie definitely seems that, you know, it's not like they're working a sting, they see Otis on the street, you know?
Yeah, well, maybe they have an ongoing investigation. Because, like, the one guy's like, he might even lead us to the big guy, and the other guy goes, Lex Luthor? So maybe it's one of those things where it's like, you know, like the Kingpin, he's sort of always been there doing things, but they just don't have hard evidence, so they can't really get him.
Yeah, I guess so, but he does dirty work himself, man.
That's a very 70s thing, though. Like, it's funny because this movie is so, like, bright and like positive and energetic, and it came out, you know, at the end of a decade where American film sort of went into a new wave of like realistic crime driven films in a lot of ways, and the Metropolis sequences definitely sort of feel like they could be part of a different movie in some ways. You know, like French Connection or Seven Ups, you know, not quite as gritty as those, but like not that far away from it either. I already mentioned that the film has three distinct, you know, locations, scenes, sequences, whatever you want to call it, with Krypton, Smallville, and Metropolis. But I think what we didn't talk about, the cinematography, Jeffrey Unsworth shot the film. He also did 2001 A Space Odyssey, A Bridge Too Far, Cabaret. I mean, he's one of the big cinematographers of his era. And the film's pretty gorgeous.
I think the Smallville stuff in particular looks really great.
You talk about
like the mid-America look, but it's, you know, it's beautiful, like the cornfield, the sunset. It's a pretty compelling looking sequence.
The Cheerios boxes.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Product placement. But yeah, like there's a lot of the Searchers and John Ford quality to his work with Smallville. A lot of silhouettes. Clark opening the barn doors to go in and get the green crystal is like one of those iconic images, I think. And when Martha Kent is looking out the window with the Cheerios box, and Clark is contemplating his trip north, I guess, in the field. Like, that's a beautiful shot. Like, there's just, you know, there's
like over her shoulder and stuff, right?
Yeah, and well, then there's a reverse shot from the outside that looks at her on the face through the window, and there's sort of like a reflection across the window too. It's just gorgeous work. And he used, I guess, like fog filters when he shot the movie. So everything on Krypton and Smallville and even a lot of scenes in Metropolis have a very sort of like old Hollywood soft focus look to them, which is just, I said beautiful already, but it's just beautiful. I love the look of this movie.
I definitely don't think that like Metropolis ever looks as good as Krypton or Smallville. But maybe that's just like the confined nature of it.
No, I think you're right. There's not a lot of shots.
Well, it uses, in Metropolis, he is Superman. So a lot of the exteriors that you see tend to use him in green screen. So that does distract a bit.
Yeah, you're getting rear projection. So the quality of those shots aren't quite as good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But, you know, with Krypton, it's so otherworldly and futuristic. And with Smallville, you've got that sort of, like, you know, Norman Rockwell, natural, simple feeling to it. And with Metropolis, you know, you're getting sort of like that, you know, okay, this is reality. Smallville seems like it's in the past, and Krypton seems like it's in the future. And Metropolis seems like it's in the here and now, so it doesn't pop as well. But I think I think maybe that makes like the idea of Superman pop more visually, like the bright colors of his suit against the sort of like gray background of Metropolis. Like it makes him pop out more.
Yeah, definitely. With his bright red cape and bright red boots. I can't really do an accent of whatever movie.
Take the man's cape, Otis. I don't think he wants me to. So what do we think about the end of this film? Because I know a lot of people really hate the end of this film.
I'm perfectly fine with it. I mean, it's, you know, at the time, like, that's something that would have happened in a Superman comic.
Yeah.
It's kind of all-powerful.
I kind of feel like that's something you would see definitely. Like, here's the thing, and you are more of an expert on this than I am, so I'm gonna make this point, and if you want to continue on with it, go for it. Superman the movie is based in an era where comics were looked at as comic strips or funny books and not serious like art. And so, and I don't mean that I don't mean that to belittle the work that comic artists and comic writers did, but I mean like it was just not looked at as anything more than that. Once the 80s hit and you started getting The Dark Knight Returns and all those other more darker, more adult stories, comic books sort of got elevated to a different status. And so comic book movies now are looked at as being based on graphic novels and comics, and there's a different weight to it. But the ending of Superman is... The movie was made by a bunch of guys who looked at Superman as a comic strip character. And so it could be fun, and it could be silly, and it could be something that defied, you know, every ounce of your logical being, and it was still okay, because it was a comic strip. And I think him flying around the world and turning back time is a perfect comic strip ending. And I love it.
Yeah, I'm absolutely fine with it. I think the argument that, you know, it's illogical. I mean, you're watching a guy fly around in, like, with his underwear on the outside. I think I don't know what people want necessarily out of that. Like, I mean, if you want realism, turn on the news, or, you know, stick your head outside. If you want a movie, this is escapism. It's Superman. It's not meant to be literal. You know, Superman, he's there as a character. Now, this is going to go into my interpretation of the character a bit. But Superman's a character who's there to inspire. He's there to be an example, a shining example of what can be, what should be. It's the ideal. It's not reality.
Right, absolutely. So, you know, what was Superman going to do? Punch a guy and bring Lois back to life?
Yeah. Or, you know, next scene is, you know, deleted scene. He's at Lois's funeral.
Well, Lois's death, quote unquote, is really rough to watch. It's harrowing.
It's pretty scary, I think. I remember as a kid being creeped out by it.
And Margot Kidder...
Terrifying. Like... Did they really put her in, like, or bury her alive? Jeez.
It seems like they did. And I agree. Like, it is a rough scene to watch. Sorry.
I don't know, it sounded like you had more to say, but nothing came.
I did. I was yawning. it's a really rough scene to watch. And when Christopher Reeve basically sits her down, and he has his sort of breakdown, and then the anger comes over him, and he screams and shoots up into the sky. Like, that is a really powerful moment, you know, for me as a viewer. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think if you don't have that sequence of them flying around Metropolis and falling in love, and that, you know, can you read my mind sequence? I don't think the ending works as well, because you don't buy that they're in love otherwise.
I guess so.
I'm going to bat for you, Richard Donner.
Okay. That does lead into, you know, we're talking about how you said harrowing her death scene is. Once he does reverse time and rescue her, there's that bit where, you know, almost immediate bit of levity where, you know, she begins to suspect Clark is Superman, and then Jimmy takes a picture of her and, you know, takes pictures of her for, you know, I guess probably about 10 seconds, and he's like, oh, wait, I didn't have any film in my camera. Did you not have camera film in your camera the whole time? Like, when did you have time to lose? Like, you're taking pictures over, like, Hoover Dam.
Well, he had a satchel or something with him. Did he lose that? I don't remember.
Takes out film and doesn't reload it.
Well, there was a lot going on, Cesar, and he's a boy. He's a teenager.
Being set on location, then, kid.
Well, he was with Lois.
Yeah, they were so close together. He was at Hoover Dam, and she was driving in the desert.
Yeah, he was at Hoover Dam, and there were no other tourists there, too. Like, was Hoover Dam not a tourist spot in the 70s?
I don't know. I mean,
these are questions that need to be answered.
Yeah, ask McClure, man. I'm sure he knows.
The oldest McFly.
Yeah, that's all he is, the oldest McFly.
We should do a Back to the Future episode. I don't know why I've been thinking about that movie a lot recently.
I'm all aboard for it.
Yeah, well, it'll have to wait. We have a couple planned already, but...
Yeah.
All right, anyway. Anything else that you want to point out or talk about?
I mentioned that Superman is my second favorite superhero. One of the things I really like about Superman is the nobility and the goodness of the character. So, you know, the movie features scenes like... in particular, like the moment before Superman goes into like his 12-year stay in the Fortress of Solitude, where you have the talking head element of Jor-El, Marlon Brando's character, talking about the possibility and like of what humans can become,
right?
You know, versus grace and goodness and kindness, and that scene is extended in this 3-hour version. But that scene, I really like about this longer cut of the movie.
There's actually that scene after he has his first night out where he goes back to the Fortress of Solitude and Brando says, you have to keep your secret identity. And he says, why? And he's like, because they will endlessly call for you because that is their, that is their nature or something like that. I like that, that little addition.
Yeah. I mean, it's, just in summation, Brando's stuff in this movie is good.
Yeah. I don't know if it's worth whatever it was, $4 million for the time that he spent on the movie, but he was the highest paid actor ever for this movie. Not anymore, but at the time, he was the highest paid actor.
Yeah. He was the biggest star in the world at the time.
He was pretty big. I mean, this is 1978, so this is after Godfather. When did Last Tango in Paris come out?
It's like 76, 77 or something.
What would have been after that then?
Yeah, so this right after Last Tango, I guess.
Yeah. So he was on his, forgive me, Brando fans, but he was on his downslide at this point. But yeah, he's good in it, definitely. You know, I mean... You need an actor with gravitas to play Jor-El, and they got the biggest name they could. So good for them. Yeah. And it certainly was a draw. I mean, Christopher Reeve was a nobody, so like they sold this movie to the studio and to audiences on the basis of it's going to be Superman, and we have Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman. So that's what got the movie made, and I'm okay with it because I love this fucking movie.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll ever rewatch this 3-hour version again. I do prefer probably the director's cut of the movie, though, overall.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'll probably watch it again just because I went out and bought the Blu-ray, so I might as well.
Yeah. Well, I also, I think you mentioned in an early episode that you do have it, but like that 9 or 10 disc set on Blu-ray that has the other films, Superman Returns, and some. And like a good amount of supplemental features.
Yeah, in the tin box, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I do have that. Yep.
It's a good box set.
It's a terrific box set. none of them are Blu-ray though. So I mean, I'll still watch them that way. But if I feel like popping a Blu-ray in.
No. What am I thinking of then? Because I have Blu-rays.
For that tin box set.
I think it's a tin. Because it also has that Superman documentary, Look Up in the Sky. That's on Blu-ray, but the only way you could get on Blu-ray was if you bought the box set.
Huh.
Because I also
own maybe it is Blu-ray. I don't know. I don't think it is though. But I'll maybe you have a Blu-ray. Maybe I don't. You
know, maybe the Blu-ray is only 6 discs though. I don't know.
I don't know. In any case. One other thing that got that I love about the 3-hour version, or I don't love, but I think it's funny. We talked earlier about how they expand into what Lois is reporting on when she's out in California.
Uh-huh.
When Superman reverses time, well, before Superman reverses time, there's a shot of water from the Hoover Dam being diverted because of what Superman does. to the Native American tribal lands. And there's a scene of the Native Americans kind of like standing up and saying, water, water. It's all flowing into like their community. And then when Superman reverses time, all the water goes back. So they lose it.
That's okay. They already sold the land to Lex anyway.
I know, but that part sucks. For them, anyway. It sucks.
Well, it is what it is. You got to reconcile what stayed and what stayed the same and what didn't.
Yeah.
We had a whole discussion 10 minutes ago about this.
I love the credit sequence in this movie, too. We didn't talk about it at the beginning, but it's amazing.
Yeah.
And the space footage, like all the sort of like swirls and things like that were was macro photography of algae by an Oxford scientist. That's pretty cool. That's a nice little tidbit.
That's something I did not know.
Yeah. Well, Darren Aronofsky used a similar technique when he made The Fountain. A lot of the special effects in The Fountain were done using macro photography of like chemical reactions. And that was done to cut the budget. It was way cheaper than producing computer-generated effects. I'm sure he got that idea from, because he's a big comic book fan, I'm sure he got that idea from the sequences in Superman.
Good spot.
Yeah. Cool. All right, man. I think I'm good on this.
Yeah, I think so, too. What else is there to say? It's a classic superhero film, one of the most iconic films of the 70s.
Yeah, it was a gigantic hit. It was number one for like 13 weeks. It made a ton of money in 1978 dollars. And it's still one of the most iconic, you know, portrayals of the character, if not the most iconic.
Yep.
Sorry, Henry Cavill, and your CGI upper lip.
You still got time. We'll see what you can do with it.
I don't mind Henry Cavill. I don't want to turn this into a discussion about that, but I think he's all right. He's just no Christopher Reeve.
Sure, but who is?
Right, nobody, that's why. So I love Superman, and you should too. Rewatch Superman the movie and tell us what you think. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Be part of the discussion.
Yeah. Tell us, you know, go ahead and tweet at me about how I'm wrong about Lois Lane's Can You Read My Mind sequence.
Yeah, you could also tweet about how I'm right about that sequence.
Well, I'll definitely get more tweets about it than you.
I guess so.
Like, CJ, that sequence sucks. That's all right.
They're not wrong. They're not wrong.
No, they are wrong. They are wrong. Where? That sequence right. Rocks.
I forgive you, man, for being incorrect.
Okay. I'm okay with it. That's fine. If I get outvoted, that's no problem, but I'll still enjoy it.
Okay.
And I won't be the only one.
That's what the point is, though. The yeah. Discussion. That's why we do this.
I know. So what are we doing next? Are we doing Reservoir Dogs?
Yeah, that was, I think that was bandied around. I'm pretty... I guess I'd say I'm looking forward to it. I'm pretty excited to revisit it. It's been a really long time since I've seen Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, me too. So I actually have the Blu-ray, but I have not watched it, so I will crack that sucker open.
You know, I don't think I own the Blu-ray. I think I bought the tin, like the oil, like the gas can version on DVD. I don't think I ever actually opened it up, though.
Yeah.
So the last time I watched the film in its entirety was when... the Mr. Brown edition came out.
Ooh, Reservoir Dogs is one of those titles that they've repackaged every couple of years, no matter what.
Yeah.
I tell you, I don't want to get into what's happening right now with Harvey Weinstein, but man, that guy repackaged shit all the time. Reservoir Dogs had like at least a dozen different versions on DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah. Like six different versions at one time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, cool. Do you have anything else you want to talk about for this episode?
No, I guess nothing specific. We talked about Superman, and I'm pretty happy about it.
Awesome. Me too. So we will see you guys next time for our episode on Reservoir Dogs. So make sure that you catch up with that one and join the discussion. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame. And Cesar, where are you?
You can find me at filmsmash.com or on Twitter at Junior Vijo.
There you go. All right, rock and roll. Thanks, Cesar.
All right, thanks, CJ.
All right, talk to you soon.
See ya.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.